This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Down to Business. My name is Jeff, and I'm recording this episode from the Mind's Eye studio just outside St. Louis in Belleville, Illinois. In today's episode, we'll explore a variety of stories from some of my favorite business publications, including Fast Company, Fortune, and Forbes. So settle in. It's time to get down to business. Our first article for this episode comes from CNBC, and the headline is, At 20, he cold emailed Mark Cuban and landed a $350,000 investment. Now the company is worth $4.6 billion. Cloud storage and file sharing business Box is worth $4.6 billion. It might never have gotten off the ground 20 years ago if Mark Cuban hadn't been closely monitoring his email. In 2005, Box CEO and co-founder Aaron Levie was still a student at the University of Southern California, where he was developing a cloud-based data storage startup from his dorm room. Since the company needed funding to get started, co-founder Dylan Smith contributed roughly $20,000 he earned playing online poker. Then the summer before their junior year of college, Levie and his three co-founders, Smith, Sam Goads, and Jeff Queisser, received an $80,000 seed round from angel investors to help them get Box incorporated as an official business and launch their initial product, Levie says. Still, the founders knew that they would need a lot more to build out the platform and attract enough customers to turn it into a viable business. So Levie started sending cold emails to every potential investor he could think of, including Mark Cuban. If you were even remotely an investor in 2005, you got an email from me, Levie says. He estimates that he reached out to dozens of investors from anywhere in the world, starting in his hometown of Seattle, then expanding out into Silicon Valley and even Cuba in Texas. There was any theoretical chance that you could invest in the company, I was probably emailing you. Cuban responded just a few hours after the students reached out. The billionaire entrepreneur and then owner of the Dallas Mavericks initially proposed working together on a data hosting project for one of his businesses, but then it basically expanded from there. Cuban agreed to invest $350,000 before he'd even met Levie and his Box co-founders in person. That was wild because it happened so fast, says Levie. Cuban's funding represented Box's breakthrough investment, he adds, which gave him the confidence to drop out of college and focus on building the company. Cuban maintains a public email address and checks it regularly. As of 2020, he received up to 1,000 emails pitches per day, he told CNBC, in November of 2020. However, the billionaire is a tough sell. Cuban estimates he deletes roughly 90% of those messages, and it only takes him a couple of seconds to decide if he's interested. Levie insists Cuban received the same pitch as everyone else, consisting of Levie's observation that online data storage was getting cheaper, the internet was getting faster, and with more people using a variety of devices for work and personal use, there was an opportunity for a company to make it easier to securely store data online and allow people to work from anywhere, he says. So why did that resonate with Cuban specifically? Cuban did not immediately respond to CNBC, make its request for comment. Levie believes the tech billionaire was just very primed for that pitch, particularly because Cuban's time developing the streaming media market in the 1990s likely meant that he was familiar with the need for more online data and storage options. I think our pitch just landed at the right time with him. Still, the Box co-founders weren't sure Cuban would respond so quickly or at all. In fact, Levie admits that basically all of his cold email pitches were shots in the dark. But that was the idea, he says. I don't know what part of my brain didn't develop properly, but I don't see it as any risk of pinging people and pitching people out of the blue. You just have to have as many at-bats as possible. Levie offers similar advice to young entrepreneurs today. Email everybody, he says, reasoning that you have little to lose by doing so. Most of the time, they're not going to respond. But the good news about math is that you'll catch the one that does, whether it's an investor or a prospect or somebody you want to hire. So to this day, I love emailing people that I want to work with. Working out of Smith's parents' attic in Mercer Island, Washington, and then from Levie's uncle's garage in Berkeley, California, the co-founders put Cuban's investment to use. They hired contract engineers who helped develop their product and put money towards server costs, online marketing, and a 1-800 phone number for customer service, Levie says. We didn't pay ourselves anything. That was just purely like, let's grow the business as much as possible, he says. Just a year after Cuban made his investment, however, the billionaire had a change of heart. He and the Box co-founders disagreed on the decision to pivot to a freemium business model, where Box gave away a free gigabyte of online storage to attract more customers. Cuban didn't like that idea or the fact that Box would have to take on additional venture funding to subsidize the cost of customer acquisition, Levee said in a 2012 interview with design company Zurb. Box raised more money in 2006, a $1.5 million funding round led by VC firm Draper Fisher Juverson, according to TechCrunch, and Levee used part of that capital to buy out Cuban's stake. In 2014, when Box went public in an IPO that valued the company at $1.7 billion, Cuban reflected on his decision to walk away. He wrote on Twitter that he would combust if he was responsible for a business with losses that outweighed revenue, like Box's did at that point. At the time of the IPO, Box had still not yet turned a profit. Box has posted an annual profit each year since 2023, though, with the company reporting net income of $129 million in 2024. While their partnership was short-lived, Cuban's investment helped kickstart Box's initial growth, and 20 years later, Levee vividly remembers the excitement he and his co-founders felt when they received Cuban's email. It's very surreal when you see the name of somebody that you hold in high esteem in your inbox, Levee says. That's a very good feeling. It may have been the first time ever that I felt the rush of like, wait, I'm sorry, Mark Cuban literally responded. His name is literally in the sender line. We were just super pumped about that it actually happened. Our next article comes from Entrepreneur magazine entitled, "She Turned a Temporary Post-College Job into Starting a Business at 23. Then some eye-opening advice helped her grow it to $5 million. Brooke Wilson turned a part-time temporary role into a $5 million business with a combination of ambition, team building, and learning to delegate. When Brooke Wilson graduated from college with a degree in graphic design, she imagined a future full of ad campaigns and client pitches. I wanted to be a creative director at an advertising company, she says. That was my goal. But first, she needed a paycheck. Just out of school and living in Durham, North Carolina, she took what she thought would be a temporary summer job with a local Two Men in a Truck franchise. Then something surprising happened. I fell in love with the business, she says. It was very dynamic. Every day is different. You're solving problems and working with the staff and the customers. It was kind of exciting. That excitement grew into ambition, and Wilson quickly rose through the company's ranks and at just 23 years old opened her own Two Men in a Truck franchise in Durham in 2017. But at first, success came at a steep cost. As a first-time business owner, Wilson ran into a common problem, burnout. She tried to do everything herself and often did. I was working in the business from 7:30 in the morning till at least 7 at night, and then I had to be the owner of the business after that, she says. That meant doing the books, handling payroll, and everything else that fell outside of day-to-day operations. I was wearing myself out. She wasn't just tired, she was stuck. Growth had stalled, and the business was showing signs of strain. Then she got an unexpected opportunity. MBA students at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business were looking for local companies to evaluate. Wilson agreed to let them dig into her business, but it wasn't easy. She had to open her books and have a candid and frank conversations about how the business was running. Their assessment was blunt and life-changing. They said, "You're holding your business back because you're trying to do it all," she recalls. "You need to let go." The students advised her to hire people for bookkeeping, finance, and human resources. They said to find the things I'm really good at and delegate the rest, Wilson says. With that outside perspective, she began hiring and trusting others to lead. That single moment, she says, is what finally unlocked growth. It was incredibly eye-opening, she says. The feedback changed everything. Once she stepped back, Wilson's business stepped up. She added two more territories in the Triangle area of North Carolina, comprised of Durham, Raleigh, and Chapel Hill, in the past 5 years, and today those franchises generate more than $5 million in annual revenue. Wilson credits her long-term success to the same thing that saved her from burnout, her staff. If we focus on our people, then our people will focus on the customer side of things, she says. The employees will take care of the business, and then the business will grow from there. When hiring, she looks for cultural fit first, not just ambition. A lot of leaders think that every hire needs to be someone who wants to climb the ladder, she says. But there are people who just love their job and contribute in a meaningful way. They have just as much value to the organization. Two Men in a Truck brand president Randy Shaka said, who started with the company as an intern in 2000, concurs. Finding somebody that has the amazing attitude that wants to be part of the team culture and fits with our purpose of moving people forward is what most important to us, he says. It's about finding the people that believe what we believe, first and foremost. Moreover, Shaka says 40% of the brand's franchise owners started in their home office, working on phones or working in the field on a truck. As the Durham area has grown, so has Wilson's business, but she isn't rushing to expand for expansion's sake. I wouldn't say I'm interested in buying more territories just to grow, she says, but if the right opportunity came along, I'm always listening. That competitive nature is instilled with me. Wilson says she never saw herself as an entrepreneur, and that's why franchising worked. There's a demonstrated brand and process. It's almost like a cut-and-paste template, she says. It still needs to be customized by market, but it's a great way in. Her biggest advice for others looking to step into an unexpected opportunity: be open and always take care of your employees, because the employee is the backbone of any company. Our next article is from the Wall Street Journal, and it's entitled America's College Towns Go From Boom to Bust. At Western Illinois University, an empty dorm that once held 800 students is now a police training ground, where active shooter drills have left behind overturned furniture, rubber-tipped bullets, and paintball casings. Nearby dorms have been raised to two more dorms are set to close this summer. Frat houses and homes once filled with student renters are empty lots. City streets used to be so crowded during the semester that cars moved at a crawl. No more. It's almost like you're watching the town die, said Khalib Magruder, who was born in Macomb and worked 28 years for the Western Illinois Campus Police Department. Macomb is at the heart of a new rust belt across the U.S. Colleges are faltering, and so are the once booming towns around them. Enrollment is down at many of the nation's public colleges and universities, widening the gap between high-profile campuses and struggling schools. Starting next year, there will be fewer high school graduates for the foreseeable. The fallout extends to downtown Macomb. Sullivan Taylor Coffee House, located in the corner of a stately 130-year-old building not far from campus, sits mostly empty during the semester. Owner Brandon Thompson has cashed out retirement savings, hit the limits of his credit cards, even canceled his home internet to keep the doors. We're down to the bare bones, says Thompson, who is thinking about filing for bankruptcy. For generations, colleges around the U.S. fueled local economies, creating jobs and bringing in students to shop and spend. Growing student enrollment fattened school budgets and freed universities from having to worry about inefficiencies or cutting costs. The student boom has since ended, and college towns are suffering. Among metropolitan areas especially reliant on higher education, three-quarters of them suffered weaker economic growth between 2011 and 2023 when compared to the U.S. as a whole. In the prior decade, most of these same metro areas grew faster than the nation did. It's just been one financial crisis after another for the past 15 or 17 years, said Andrew Korich, executive director of the Alliance for Research on Regional Colleges and a professor of higher education at Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina. It starts to accumulate in smaller college towns, especially for colleges that don't have billions of dollars in the bank. College towns are now threatened by federal funding cuts from the Trump administration, resulting in hiring freezes and layoffs at Ivy League and state schools alike. Administration efforts to cancel student visas might hurt state college budgets, since most international students pay higher out-of-state tuition. Even worse, the number of students graduating from American high schools is expected to start falling next spring, after reaching a record high this year. In 2007, the number of U.S. births peaked at 4.3 million and has been falling almost every year. Large flagship universities, blessed with strong academic reputations and high-profile sports programs, continue to boost local economies. In such cities as Ann Arbor, Michigan, University of Michigan, Madison, Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin, and Gainesville, Florida, the University of Florida, students fill dorms and restaurants and bars. A Wall Street Journal analysis of 748 public four-year colleges and universities in all 50 states shows that full and part-time enrollment at the most prominent state universities increased 9% in 23 compared with 2015. At lesser-known regional state universities, enrollment actually fell by 2%. The shift represents tens of thousands of students who have abandoned struggling college towns. At the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, the state's flagship school, enrollment jumped 30% in 23 compared with 2015. Enrollment at Tennessee's 10 regional state colleges fell a combined 3% over the same period. In Wisconsin, enrollment at the University of Wisconsin in Madison jumped 16% and fell 9% at regional public campuses over the same period. Between 2011 and 2023, the economies of the metropolitan areas that include Madison and Knoxville grew faster than the U.S. as a whole. More students are opting out of college after high school, calculating that tuition prices as well as the opportunity cost of lost work years aren't worth it. Smaller, less distinguished private schools have similar troubles, which have resulted in the closures of at least 242 institutions that issue college degrees in the past decade, according to the Hechinger report, which covers education. Of students choosing to enter college, more of them are aiming for prestigious universities, believing those diplomas will get them better jobs, said Richard Vetter, an economist at Ohio University who studies higher education. It's a flight to quality, he said. The flagship University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign campus is booming. Enrollment this past academic year was up 36% from 2010. Last fall, facing a shortage of space, the university doubled up students in dorm rooms. From 2010 to 2023, the economy of the metropolitan region surrounding the Urbana-Champaign campus grew at more than twice the pace of the county containing Western Illinois. In Macomb, about 140 miles west of Urbana-Champaign, the city's population fell 23% to an estimated 14,000 from 2010 to 2024. The enrollment at Western Illinois University's Macomb campus has fallen 47% since 2010 to 5,500 from 10,377. Falling enrollment shifts more of the financial burden to state governments, and government funding hasn't kept up with rising costs. A budget standoff in the Illinois State House froze state funding for almost 2 years between 2015 and 2017, forcing layoffs and budget cuts. The freeze hit Western Illinois particularly hard given its falling enrollment. School officials cut programs and raised fees, making it tough to attract new students. Some cuts are easy to see. It needed repairs to sidewalks and buildings, according to the university's vice president for student success. A state bill to increase funding for struggling universities is the talk of the town. Cracks and holes in campus walkways are so deep they have makeshift barriers. On a recent spring day, the quad in the middle of campus drew only a handful of students. Sandbags lined an academic building no longer used. One bright spot on campus is the $100 million-plus Performing Arts Center being built with state funds for new infrastructure projects. Fewer students at the university also mean fewer professors. We're down a lot of faculty members, said Ty Kenny, who graduated this month with a degree in agricultural business. They're all stretched to the absolute max. Layoffs and attrition have shrunk campus enrollment by 38% in the last 11. It's just this big snowball, Krista Bowers-Sharp says, an associate professor and librarian. She got laid off this month after 28 years. Macomb's fortunes have been closely tethered to Western Illinois for decades. In the 1960s and 70s, an army of baby boomers enrolled in colleges, seeking degrees in a U.S. economy tilting away from manufacturing jobs to white-collar work. Western Illinois, founded in 1899, put up new campus buildings to accommodate its surging enrollment, which peaked at 15,000 in 1973. Macomb became quite the boomtown, says Mayor Michael Inman, who attended Western Illinois in the 70s. Small businesses just popped up everywhere. Campus enrollment has fallen by more than half since 1973, with much of the decline after 2011. City sales tax revenue has dropped almost proportionally with the number of students during that period. Holly Stovall canceled her gym membership, switched to a cheaper supermarket, and stopped paying for housekeeper after losing her job as a women's studies professor in Western Illinois in 2017. She also stopped donating to a local public radio station. Saving money on dining out wasn't hard. The restaurant's closed, she said, so you didn't have to worry about that. Recently, she and her husband, Tom, an economics professor at Western Illinois, moved to Chicago, where Stovall is teaching part-time, she said. A class here and a class there. Sadler commutes to Macomb for part of each week by train to teach his classes. Macomb isn't a great place to be if you don't have a job. Vitali's restaurant and pizzeria used to stay open some nights until 2 a.m. Now we can barely stay open until 9, says Julie Dienst, the daughter of owner Concetta Vitali. The family wants to sell but can't find a buyer. Nelson's Clothing, located in a row of two-story commercial buildings across from an ornate county courthouse, struggles to hire because the once-abundant student labor pool has dried up. The city is looking to diversify its economy, the mayor said, and relieve its dependency on the university. Roller bearing maker NTN Bauer and window maker Pella run factories in Macomb's Eastern Fridge, employing more than 1,000 people, according to the Regional Economic Development Corporation. Reversing decades of declines, the total number of manufacturing jobs in the city is actually up. Inman touts the recently opened TJ Maxx and Hobby Lobby stores, as well as plans for the city's first Chipotle Mexican Grill. Further off is a proposal for a municipal sports complex with indoor basketball and volleyball courts and 4,000 seats to host tournaments. Ann Thomas, who owns a shaved ice stand in downtown Macomb, isn't betting on economic improvement. Her husband, a Western Illinois music professor, worries about losing his job. They are considering selling their house and moving into a rental as a hedge against the city's continued decline. They worry a flood of new layoffs will depress housing prices. My husband used to feel pretty secure, Thomas said, but not anymore. There's definitely a cloud. Our next article this week comes from The Guardian, and the title is "This Pause in the Trade War Will Be Brief. Small Businesses Plan Accordingly." Trump's animosity toward China isn't going to disappear, and his past actions do not bode well for a quick resolution. For starters, the tariffs that weren't paused, a 10% levy on all Chinese goods, plus a bonus 20% tax that somehow relates to fentanyl, are still in place. When you take into consideration existing tariffs on steel from previous Trump and Biden administrations, the effective tariff rate on Chinese goods is actually closer to 40%, according to an analysis done by the Wall Street Journal. That's a big number. Maybe that won't deter people from buying underwear at Target, but for companies that rely on steel and aluminum, semiconductors, synthetic fabrics, plastics, minerals, coatings and solvents, as well as certain bearings, motors, pumps, and parts, a 30 to 40% hike is a major impact on their margins, which will affect their spending and investments. Ultimately, the cost of the end products that use these materials will also rise as companies simply pass them on to consumers. Just as important, Trump's animosity towards China, unfounded or not, isn't going to just magically disappear. He called the Chinese cheaters, polluters, and thieves, and his past actions, particularly in his first administration, do not bode well for a quick resolution to this issue. In 2018, the Trump administration not only imposed onerous tariffs on China, but also issued some very harsh requirements to address trading issues with its closest economic rival. There were specific quotas set to limit our trade deficit. There were demands made to reduce the Chinese requirement, forcing American companies to share or transfer technology with their Chinese counterparts. There were rules aimed at stopping the alleged stealing of data and intellectual property by the Chinese. The problem is that none of this happened. What happened shortly after the negotiations started was COVID, and then in 2020, a new administration. But don't think that Trump won't raise these issues again. He will, and when this happens, we'll be back to the same place we started, excessive tariffs and a trade war with China. That doesn't mean that businesses are completely stuck. Many, those that have the funds, are using the tariff suspension to buy up products from China like it's a fire sale at Costco on Black Friday. Others are contracting with bonded warehouses and storage facilities in free trade zones to accept products that are temporarily tariff-free, hoping that they will pull materials from these storage units, those rates will have come down. I have clients who are aggressively searching for alternative suppliers. I have others who are bringing their assembly and manufacturing back to the U.S. those that aren't able to make those kinds of investments are trying to work how and how much they can charge pricing and what the market will take. A few have already created special line items on their invoices to separate out the tariff charge in an effort to say, hey, don't blame me for this stuff. My smartest clients started doing this stuff the day after Trump was elected. They listened to what he'd said during the previous couple of years, and they read the writing on the wall. Now they're ahead of the game, and good for them. Companies that didn't do this, especially small businesses that have fewer resources and are more reliant on just a supplier or two, they're in trouble, particularly if they buy from China. For any business still reliant on Chinese suppliers and market, this pause isn't going to last as long as you think. There will be a lot more coming in this trade war, and let's hope it doesn't turn into an actual war. The outlook is precarious and risky. Trump is volatile and emotional and has a history of knocking China. The next article for this week's episode comes from Fast Company magazine, and it's called How to Reduce How Much Time You're Spending Staring at Screens Without Hurting Your Career. FOMO about being offline is real, but this moderate approach to digital detox can help you create reasonable boundaries. I don't know about you, but I usually cringe when I get my weekly screen time report. Did I really spend that much time online? Turns out I'm pretty average, according to Data Reportal's 2025 Global Overview Report that says adults worldwide clock in about 6 hours and 38 minutes on digital devices each day. While being average is comforting, I know I could benefit from more time unplugged. Yet the thought of a full digital detox feels scary. It's very hard to completely disconnect yourself, says Cristanio Winkler, director of digital marketing for Somebody Digital, a digital marketing agency. But anything in excess is going to have negative consequences. The question is, how can we still be present online, but not in a way that's going to cause anxiety? Worries about being offline are common, and Winkler analyzed the most common perceived career risk according to Google Trend Search data. He found three of the biggest concerns and why we shouldn't stress over them. So first, being inaccessible. People who work remotely often fear that a digital detox may portray them as inaccessible or out of the loop. For example, in our organization, we have lots of different ways of communicating with each other, he says. We've got email and WhatsApp and Slack. Some clients like to use Microsoft Teams. If you're managing 3 to 5 clients, you have to communicate with them, plus your team members. People are afraid of being inaccessible. Instead of being tethered to messages apps all day, get ahead of other people's expectations. For example, let your team members know when you'll be offline or are doing more focused work. Winkler adds that organizations should implant policies that help their employees feel more confident, placing boundaries around their time. You don't have to be 100% available all the time, he says. People will feel more comfortable having conversations, and they will become more efficient in dealing with certain tasks than before. The next fear is missing networking opportunities. Social media, such as LinkedIn, can be a valuable networking tool. Another common worry is that digital detox could cost opportunities if they don't act quickly enough. But that's not the case, says Winkler. People need to understand that they do not control how their posts are going to be presented, he says. I sometimes get comments from people on posts that I published several weeks ago because LinkedIn and other social media platforms don't necessarily show that post to everybody on my network at the same time. They usually pace out the exposure. Instead, Winkler recommends time blocking an hour per week to go through your social media channels and interact and reply. You can still keep that networking element, which is quite important, while still keeping a good balance. Next is a lagging industry awareness. In addition to networking opportunities, social media can serve as a real-time feed for industry trends and news. Implementing a digital detox may cause you to worry that you'll fall behind on emerging practices and competitor updates. If you completely disconnect yourself from important channels, you will definitely miss market trends, says Winkler. Everything happens super fast in the digital world, and I would not recommend that you disconnect completely. Instead, utilize tools to curate content for you so you can spend less time staying current. For example, Winkler recommends using news alerts and filters. or subscribe to channels and newsletters that package relevant information and events that happened last week in your field. In the digital marketing world, for example, there are amazing channels on LinkedIn and other social media platforms that will summarize everything for you and will give you a snapshot of what you need to know. You can consume what is relevant and you know and spend more time on the topics that will have a direct impact on your career. It's using technology in your favor. Finally, finding balance. You don't need to go offline for long stretches of time to improve your relationship with the digital world. While it's natural to be concerned about being inaccessible, missing network opportunities and industry awareness, it's also possible to create balance with boundaries, leveraging technologies as a tool, and not let it take over your life and habits. That's a true digital detox, he says. The benefits outweigh the concerns of not always being available by quite a margin. It can take time to establish, but you will see positive impact. The goal is to be present online, but not in a way that's going to cause anxiety. Sticking with Fast Company, our next article is entitled, Can Mozzarella Sticks Save America's Fast Casual Restaurants? Chili's saucy mozzarella sticks have become a viral sensation. Now TGI Fridays is hoping the fried finger food can help revive its brand. America's fast casual restaurants are almost universally struggling. But a few chains are betting on one beloved fried finger food to draw customers back into booths, the humble mozzarella stick. Over the past year or so, the fast casual sector has faced a chilling effect as inflation and rising menu prices continue to drive customers away. Last year, chains including Red Lobster, Tijuana Flats, Buca del Pepo, and BurgerFi all sought bankruptcy protection. Others like Dine Brands, the owner of Applebee's and IHOP, and Darden, the owner of Olive Garden, have recently reported lackluster financial results. Amidst the dreary environment, Chili's, the fast casual restaurant known for its margaritas and appetizers, is having a shockingly good year. The brand saw a 31% jump in sales in the second quarter of 25 compared to the same period last year, alongside a nearly 20% increase in traffic. Chili's parent company, Brinker International, raked in a total sales of about $1.3 billion for the second quarter compared to about $1.1 billion the prior year. A good portion of Chili's success can be attributed to several viral appetizers, most notably its fried mozzarella sticks, which have boosted the restaurant's visibility in the cultural zeitgeist. Now, TGI Fridays seems to be taking a page out of Chili's book to revitalize its dying brand by putting mozzarella sticks front and center. In a January earnings call, Chili's CEO Kevin Hochman laid out a few of the changes driving Chili's recent success, including simplifying the menu, upgrading ingredients, and crucially, investing in a social media marketing campaign centered around appetizers. Back in April of 24, Chili's partnered with a number of social media influencers to market its Triple Dipper, an appetizer plate that lets customers choose three different dishes, the mozzarella sticks, which were added to the menu in 2002, being one of the most popular choices. The collabs took off, spawning dozens of TikToks with viewerships and the hundreds of thousands of influencers sampling both the Triple Dipper and the mozzarella sticks by themselves. The mozzarella sticks developed a kind of cult online fan base, both for their chunky rectangular form factor and for their cheese pull properties. A measurement of how stretchy melted cheese is that is sought after characteristic for food-based content creators. The appetizer was so popular among young fans on TikTok that the company introduced two new flavors in 24, Nashville Hot Moz and Honey Chipotle Moz, which predictably spawned another wave of Chili's mozzarella stick reviews. We're absolutely seeing a younger generation discovering and loving Chili's, especially through TikTok, George Felix, Chili's senior vice president and chief marketing officer, told Fast Company. The Triple Dipper took off with guests making cheese pull videos with our fried mozzarella. Social media is playing a real role in how new audiences connect with the brand. In all, Hochman told investors, interest in the Triple Dipper doubled year over year, jumping from accounting for 7% of total sales all the way up to 4%. It looks like TGI Fridays is now hoping to dip into the mozzarella stick craze in an effort to revive its business as well. It's been a rough several years for TGI Fridays. In early 24, the chain abruptly shuttered a series of underperforming stores. Then in December, it filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, citing financial difficulties from the COVID-19 pandemic as the main factor driving the decision. Today, the company has whittled down its presence in the U.S. to just 85 stores, compared to 600 during its heyday in 2006. Now under CEO Ray Blanchett, who previously ran the company between 2018 and 2023 and returned again in January, TGI Fridays is taking a bold risk to turn its fate around. In an interview with CNN this week, Blanchett shared that the company is planning to change 85% of its menu to streamline the available options and attract both Gen Zers and millennials. To start, the company is paring back on the more out-there items on the menu. At one point, oddly, that included sushi, introducing a new signature sauce and revamping its cocktail menu. According to Blanchett, the new drink offerings include 7 signature cocktails from the company's early days, now with eye-catching colors. And they're intended to entice Gen Zers who love specialty beverages. Chili's has used a similar strategy for some time, debuting a margarita of the month in neon hues that often take off on socials. And of course, TGI's Friday is introducing its own spin on the saucy mozzarella sticks. Blanchett says that its brand has offered mozzarella sticks for decades and actually helped turn them into a staple on menus across the industry. On its new menu, the chain will go stick for stick with Chili's, though flavors including Frank's Red Hot Buffalo, garlic parmesan, and whiskey glaze. For us, mozzarella sticks are not a trend, Blanchett told Fast Company. When we saw others leaning into sauced versions, we knew it was time to remind everyone who did it first, and now we're raising the bar. To spread the word, TGI Fridays has new socials team that's already jumping on mozzarella stick TikTok, including a video posted this week of mozzarella sticks getting tossed in sauce to George Michael's sensual, careless whisper. Chili's may have paved the way, but TGI Fridays will be the first test case of whether mozzarella sticks are enough to save America's fast casual restaurant. And sticking with Fast Company for one more article, the final one for this segment is entitled, What Kind of Music Makes You Most Productive at Work? Here's what the science has to say. Jamming out at a concert puts music front and center in a person's life, but only for a moment. Most of the time, music serves more as sonic wallpaper, spicing up the background while we go about the business of our day. For many people, that includes working. But is a particular kind of music better for boosting productivity? Deciding on which music to have cranking throughout the day's task, though, is something America's air-potted workforce may not be doing with much intention. The choice could be informed by mood, by recent album reviews, by a Spotify algorithm, or any number of other factors. But according to a new study, you may want to consider two important variables, predictability and novelty. Music is just such an emotional medium, says Yaron Ren, a 6-year PhD student in Georgia Tech School of Psychology. It can not only modulate how you feel at the moment, it can also modulate the memory you're recalling at the moment and how you perceive that memory yourself. As a composer and a scientist, Ren has long been interested in how music interacts with our brains. She recently put her interest into practice, conducting a series of studies with Georgia Tech's cognitive neuroscientist Thackeray Brown, who runs the university's MAP lab. One of the studies examined how music affected a subject's ability to process or remember new information. To determine whether different rhythms or melodies made an impact on people's cognitive abilities, the scientists asked 48 participants to learn sequences of abstract shapes while listening to different types of music. The study revealed that familiar, predictable music strengthened the participant, while familiar music tweaked to be more atonal put a roadblock in the participant's path. If predictability in music helps cognitive clarity and productivity while performing tasks, it shouldn't surprise anyone who gravitates to familiar favorites during the workday. But there's also something to be said for listening to new albums on the clock. While predictable music can lead to greater cognitive clarity, music that is novel to the listener may, in some ways, allow them to stick with a task longer because it contains surprising elements that can jar listeners out of complacency. Or at least that's what the impact it seems to have on some participants. The side effect led Ren to re-examine her love of jazz. The scientist grew up in China and only discovered jazz's eclectic rhythms after moving to the U.S. It quickly became a staple in her catalog of music to play while working. Now she understands why. The syntax of jazz was just a new world to me when I discovered it, and I still cannot predict it, she says. It gives me such a fresh surprise all the time. And I think that kind of surprise adds a little uncertainty and hits the sweet spot of a good mood, good attention, and focusing on the task. Listening to the same music of music all the time, though, would remove some of that novelty. And the same music doesn't translate well across all tasks. Wren shared that some recommendations based on both her studies and personal experience around which type of music help with productivity when it comes to specific types of work. First, correspondence. Whether you've reached inbox infinity or have several Slack conversations that need immediate attention, Wren has a tip. Consider listening to music with lyrics in a foreign language or music without any lyrics at all. Song lyrics in your native tongue can get tangled up with the words you're reading and formulating responses to creating a hurdle rather than guardrails. To getting work done, lyrics you can't quite understand, on the other hand, just add another element in the wall. Coding. While doing any coding work, Wren reaches for fast rock music. Propulsive rhymes are what get people dancing, she says, and having fast rock play in the background while coding never fails to get her fingers. Writing. Scientists have long debated the Mozart effect, which describes how listening to Mozart's symphonies tends to invite higher cognitive skills. Researchers think it's because Mozart's music triggers a good level of attention and arousal, Wren says, but not too many disruptions or too much tension. While a scientist does indeed find classical music to be perfect for accompanying focused writing, she prefers Beethoven or Chopin for the job. Of course, as helpful as music can be for amping up attention and focus, it isn't always necessary. Sometimes the best music to work to, Wren says. Our next article for this week's episode comes from Tasting Table, and it's called How Wendy's 4 for $4 Changed Fast Food. The year was 2015, if you can remember it. A lot has happened over the past decade. Barack Obama was the president. The Hills by The Weeknd topped the music charts. $1 had the purchasing power of $1.35 today. And Wendy's debuted 4 for $4. Gen 1 of this meal deal included a hamburger, four-piece chicken nugget, small fries, and a small drink. The 4 for $4 wasn't just a high-value fill-up. It was also evidence to consumers that modern fast food industry could actually be as affordable and convenient as they had come to expect in past. The arrival of the 4 for $4 quite literally changed the fast food game industry-wide. The bar had been set. Wendy's launched the deal in October 2015, and by February of 16, competitors were scrambling to keep pace. Burger King had already introduced a 5 for $4 meal deal to keep pace. Carl's Jr. rolled out its own 4 for $4, and McDonald's released the McPick 2. We are very happy with the early results, and we're meeting a consumer need for a compelling value with high-quality, unique offering, Emil Brolik, Wendy's president and CEO, said during a conference call back in November of 2015, 1 month after the 4 for $4 program's premiere. Even at the time of its initial release, Wendy's never promised to keep the deal forever. Now, will that always be 4 for $4? I will not share that with you, foreshadowed Emil Brolik in the November conference call. But there will be a price value message underneath that, and I think that is the most important to take away from. For low-income consumers with limited discretionary budgets, offering a permanent menu of low-cost-per-item meal bundles has proven to be an effective traffic-boosting move for fast food brands. Long before the 4 for $4, Wendy's was the first fast food giant to put the concept of the value meal on the map. In 1989, to get an edge over competitors in the 99-cent burger war, we had the idea of, rather than selling one of our big items for 99 cents, creating a whole menu with a 99-cent item, Denny Lynch, former Wendy's senior vice president of communications, told QSR back in 2010. Their original 99-cent menu included an impressive 9 items, but its impact was far larger. Burger King went on to establish a value menu in 1998, and McDonald's dollar menu followed in 2003. Nowadays, however, that pendulum seems to be swinging in the opposite direction. According to a 2024 poll by Revenue Management Solutions, about 25% of consumers making below $50,000 annually reported finding fast food too expensive to justify buying. Affordable anything has become something of an endangered species in modern American market. A 2025 report by POS system Toast found that a McDonald's quarter pounder with cheese has risen in cost by 20% in the past 6 years, while the 10-piece McNuggets meal rose 28% in the past 5 years. To retain penny-pinching customers, McDonald's has extended its $5 meal deal through the summer of 2025. And Taco Bell dropped $5, $7, and $9 value boxes available. Falling back on Wendy's high-value promotion tactic might be the fail-safe saving grace in the industry, if it's even possible to execute anymore. A Reddit post from 1 year ago asked, what happened to the 4 for $4? The thread is filled with forlorn foodies dryly lamenting that deals slow fade. It died. Inflation. Everything's more expensive now. And in another thread, soon maybe you'll get 4 nuggets for $4. Today, the meal deals section of Wendy's online menu only lists 1 4 for $4 adjacent offering. The junior cheeseburger, 4 for $4 with burger, 4-piece chicken nugget, fry, and drink. Wendy's revolutionary quartet seems to have been eclipsed in the Biggie Bag, another meal deal that includes an entire item, notably heartier sandwiches, plus a nugget, drink, and frosty and fry. At a Wendy's location in Brooklyn, the Biggie Bag costs $5 to $7 depending on the choice of sandwich, and the renamed 4 for 4 combo costs $4.40. Our next article comes from Entrepreneur magazine entitled, What AI is Actually Good For According to Science? New research reveals AI's strengths and limitations. As entrepreneurs experiment with generative AI, academic researchers are running down their own experiments. They want to know what works, what doesn't, and why. The early results are fascinating. On the following pages, we highlight studies conducted by researchers at Harvard, MIT, Columbia, and other universities, where you'll see a theme. AI cannot effectively replace people at this point, but it can be a powerful collaboration tool and in ways that you may not expect. Here's the first case study. Does Gen AI increase productivity? Science says yes, but only for certain tasks. It's taken as a given. AI boosts your productivity. But does it really? A group of researchers at the business schools of Harvard, MIT, and Warwick universities, along with the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, wanted to find out. So they assembled a team of 758 Boston Consulting Group employees and put them through a few experiments to study Gen AI's effect on their work. The investigators separated the employees, all consultants, into two groups for different experiments. In both, the subjects were first asked to solve a problem without using AI to establish a performance baseline. Then their group was given a challenge where some of the consultants were able to use GPT-4 while others were not. In the first group, the assignment was to come up with footwear ideas for niche markets. For the second group, the researchers purposely designed a task where the AI would make a mistake in its answer. In this challenge, the employees had to solve a problem for a company by assessing interviews with its insiders and evaluating quantitative data, when the consultants carefully checked the AI's work. At the end, researchers measured how productive everybody was. The results? In the first group, who had to brainstorm the footwear ideas, generative AI helped a lot. On average, the consultants using it were able to finish 12% more tasks and do them 25% faster than their peers who didn't have access. The quality of their work was also 40% higher. Interestingly, generative AI proved to be a skill leveler. It raised everybody's performance, but less experienced consultants surged 43% compared to those in the top tier who only improved 17%. For the second group tackling the company problem, not surprisingly, the outcome was very different. AI actually worsened their performance. The consultants who used GPT-4 reached correct answers only 60 to 70% of the time, but those who went without, relying just on their human brains, were correct about 84.5% of the time. What have we learned? We already know that AI is good at helping us brainstorm and that it's not great at making critical judgments about complex information, which partially explains the results of these two very different tasks. But the researchers gained further insight by watching how people who were using GPT-4. The lesson is this: be careful. Although generative AI significantly improves productivities for tasks it is good at, it can throw you off for things that it's not. When the consultants used AI to do more complex tasks, they tended to blindly accept its outputs without seriously interrogating it.
the work version of being asleep at the wheel.
The key to Gen AI is to try it for everything, to get a sense of what's good and what's bad. To use it more effectively, he suggests that treating it like a human being. The best prompters I know have no engineering skills, but they're good at working with people. Even better, tell the AI what kind of person to be. It's designed to have a generic default personality, but can adapt however you need. For example, ask it to act as a data geek or a witty comedian. The first would be better at analyzing a business question. The second at writing copy for ads that make people crack up. And our final article for this week's episode circles back to CNBC. David Alderman is leading the next generation of deal-hungry family offices. Entrepreneur and family office founder David Alderman said family offices have a growing competitive advantage over venture capital and private equity firms when it comes to investing in startups. As family offices surge in number and size, with assets now totaling over $3 trillion, they're increasingly challenging big funds for startup investments and merger deals. Alderman, whose family office Darnco Capital now has more than 90 investments in private companies, said family offices can provide more entrepreneurial expertise and more patient capital than private equity or venture funds. We're there for the long haul, he said. The CEO of Campus Apartments and the co-founder of FS Investments. All the funds are there when it's 80 degrees and sunny, when things are going great, but when it's cloudy and rainy, they aren't going to be there for you. As a serial entrepreneur, Alderman says that he knows the ups and downs startups experience. Private equity and venture funds, on the other hand, are often constrained by rigid timelines and fund requirements. During COVID, more than a dozen of Darko's portfolio companies suddenly needed capital. While the big funds balked at providing more funding, Darko extended low-cost lines of credits and support. We were the last person standing, he said. I've been there, you know. I've had some really tough times in my career. And if had somebody putting the screws to me, it could have made things worse. So I'm sympathetic, and sometimes things happen, though no fault of their own. The billionaire entrepreneur is helping to lead a new generation of more aggressive, deal-hungry family offices. Rather than simply preserving wealth for the next generation, many of today's family offices aim to launch new growth startups by investing directly and providing management expertise. A family office survey from Bastiat Partners and Caris Capital found that nearly half of family offices plan to invest in startups directly in the next 2 years, rather than through traditional funds. Still, direct deals carry risks, Alderman said, that before launching Darko, he invested in deals recommended by friends. Friends would say, here's a deal, put in X amount. So, you know, it's $250,000 or $500,000 or $1 million, whatever it is. I realized very quickly, that's probably a money-losing prospect just to invest in a friend's of a friend's idea or because someone at your country club is investing in it. He launched Darko to create formal processes of evaluating startups and making direct investments. Darko's portfolio companies range from vodka and spirits to women's shoes, energy companies, and sports teams. Along with Campus Apartments, FS, and Darko, Alderman is also a limited partner of Harris Blitzer Sports and Entertainment, which owns and operates the Philadelphia 76ers. Alderman says he gets pitched investments every day. His first rule of thumb when choosing to invest is understanding the business and business model. I will not invest in something I don't understand, he said. I'm not looking to control someone's business, but I have to understand it. Rather than investing in business models alone, Alderman said he also looks for strong founders. His investment in women's shoe company, Magnu, is driven in large part by his faith in the two female founders, Alex Buckley and Sarah Pearson, who met at Harvard. I bet on jockeys, not on horses, Alderman said. I ask if the thing fails, would we support them again? To be clear, a lot of our investments are going to fail, especially since we're early stage. But we ask, are they honest? Are they ethical? Are their values in line with ours? Most importantly, Alderman says he looks for investments that will have a positive social impact on the environment, on underserved populations, or in the community, mainly in his native Philadelphia. He says his investment is Credit AI, a Philadelphia-based fintech that helps consumers build credit through a debit card recently partnered with Starbucks and has already started improving the financial line. When you think about employees at these large companies, the question is that can you do a major employer to show that you care? The easiest way to do that is with financial. Alderman also looks for companies that benefit from synergies with his other holdings.
since Campus Apartments now houses over 250,000 students. He can spot trends among young consumers with emerging products and brands. His spirits company, Darko Spirits, which sells American Harvest Vodka and Beach Whiskey, goes well with his sports ventures and sports investments, he said. When it comes to advice for other family offices, Alderman said wealthy entrepreneurs and families should first ask themselves the hard question of whether they